It's under advisement. All right, our next case for this morning is Watson against Hulick. Mr. Rattler.
May it please the court. Of course, I'm Robert Rattler. This case comes after my client, Mr. Watson, was convicted of murder and attempted murder. He was sentenced to 60 years on the murder, 30 years on the attempted murder. There were a couple other charges, too, but they were consecutive sentences. He brought his petition, his writ for habeas corpus in the Northern District. The Honorable Judge Core denied it, Watson's relief, and Watson, of course, appealed to this court. Launching right into the contentious issues here, they come under the Fourth Amendment. And that is the very lack of intervening circumstances as required by federal Supreme Court precedent.
But could we back up and maybe start with Stone versus Powell? Because you really need to do more than show that there was a mistake in applying the Fourth Amendment. You need to show that there was a lack of a full and fair opportunity in the state courts to adjudicate it. And I have to tell you, in this case, which goes up once to the state appellate court, and then on an ineffectiveness of counsel ground, they send it back precisely on this. And there's a whole set of proceedings in the state trial court, a hearing, you know, the state trial court comes to conclusions, and then an appeal based on a much more expansive record. There's certainly an opportunity to adjudicate it, right?
I appreciate that, Your Honor, except that the opportunity fails when the court doesn't frame the correct constitutional standard.
But can you please tell me, though, how do you draw the line between something that may simply be a mistake in applying a particular Fourth Amendment rule, Brown versus Illinois maybe, and something that is so flawed that Stone versus Powell would allow us to reach that issue? It can't just be every mistake, because then we wouldn't be following Stone versus Powell. So there's a line there somewhere. Can you describe what that line is?
I think you just have to look at the precedent. The precedent requires an intervening factor be considered.
No, you're talking about, you're not answering my question. I want to know, how bad does it have to be? At what point does what happened in the state court amount to a lack of a full and fair opportunity to present your claim?
Unreasonableness is a standard that I've read about. I mean, you only have to look at the precedent and say, this case is an identical case. How can you not get there? That's unreasonable.
But isn't that just what Justice Powell was talking about in the Stone against Powell case? They didn't want relitigation on habeas of every single Fourth Amendment claim. Now, maybe you or I or anybody else might think that was good or bad policy, but that's what the Supreme Court established now 30 years ago. That's what we have to do.
I understand, Your Honor. We're not going to relitigate exclusionary rules.
Right.
But if it's a constitutional right that turns on this, his constitutional right to his Fourth Amendment right in terms of search and seizure, and the court frames the wrong rule, then Stone v. Powell does not become a bar.
Can you point to any language in Stone that suggests that if it's a mistake of law in the framing of the question, then you do get to raise it on federal habeas? I don't remember anything like that.
Yeah,
in Stone.
I'm not going to tell you. I can just point to that line. But the prodigy would tell us that when you're looking at Stone v. Powell, you're looking at the framing of the standard. Dinaway and Brown all had to go through the Stone analysis before they could get there and set forth the correct standards. But getting back to where the contention is, lack of intervening circumstances again. Dunaway, by itself, intervening circumstances, if you don't have any, right there decides the case for my client.
Well, I'm just going to point out that Brown is before Stone, so they didn't have to worry about Stone versus Powell at that point.
I apologize, Your Honor. Yeah. But here, the occurrence of my client's confession, the appellate court almost, as far as acknowledges, that my client's statement is immediate. It's immediate once he's informed of the constitutional violation, the search. And
is it all that clear? I mean, giving up on Stone for a minute, is it all that clear that he's actually, as you put it, informed of a constitutional violation? The officer says, they've searched your house. And this testimony is credited by the trial court, so we need to credit too. He might interpret that as his apartment. He might interpret that as the house as a whole. The house itself is a little bit ambiguous since it appears to be occupied entirely by members of his family. How do we know that alerts him to a Fourth Amendment violation?
Well, he goes on further and says, okay, a couple of items we're returning with alerts that. You've got a search, you've got items. And Dunaway would say in that situation, once you have come within the search and the constitutional violation, you've got the temporal proximity there, you've got to go through the attenuation factors. And Dunaway, if you're going to attenuate, the court needs to get through this intervening factor. Matter of fact, the court needs to get through all of these factors they're going to attenuate. And the court's finding on immediacy supports the defendant. Immediately, it shows that there was no break in the causal connection between the Fourth Amendment rights and Watson's confession.
Well, even if you're right about that factor, and it does look like it happened, you know, the statement is made, he decides to confess at that point. The court in Brown said this is one of these many totality kinds of tests. You have to look at everything. You don't want to get too wedded to one factor or another. And the state trial court does that. The state trial court just doesn't see anything to suggest that search is the trigger that decides that causes Mr. Watson to decide to confess.
Well, if you take yourself through
suppress the things that were found in the search, right?
They did suppress
those things. They just didn't suppress the confessions.
It's just not enough time. He's ID'd by somebody. He knows that. He thinks his brother is giving up. He knows that. It's several hours are going by, and he knows all these things. And then the officer comes in for the dinner trash and says a couple of items. Pregnant with that is this ideal that there's a connection there. There's nothing left. I want to talk. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like
sure.
to then address what the state seems to think intervening circumstances is. And I say think because they're speculating in their brief at 34 that these could be intervening circumstances. The problem is that the state court does that. They say these are temporal proximity factors. And immediately upon the temporal proximity factors analysis by the state court, bam, immediately they go right into intervening circumstances. They pass right by that, and their analysis and go right to flagrant. They just leave it totally out. Dunaway is not going to support that. The state is going to give you that these intervening circumstances could have occurred some time before. If you look at any of the court sites from the Supreme Court and any of our briefs from this circuit here, the Seventh Circuit, and the Illinois, all of these facts, all these attenuating factors come with the violation, or knowledge of the violation, and then comes the situation where we're looking at that period between Watson getting a couple of items and the confession.
I'm just going to say, if you want to save your last minute for a bit of rebuttal, this would be the time to do it.
This would be the time.
Okay.
Of course, I will. I hope you'll be looking at my brief for the significant prosecutory involvement.
Thank you. We will certainly do that. Ms. Griffin?
Good morning. May I please the court, Colleen Griffin on behalf of the respondent in this case. First, regarding Stone v. Powell and the Fourth Amendment claim before this court, the question is not whether the appellate court decision was unreasonable. That's not the standard to pierce a Stone bar. What must occur is that the petitioner has an opportunity for full and fair litigation of his claim in the state court. And to overcome that, the petitioner must show that the state court closed its ears and mind to arguments such that it did not consider the claim.
And how do you, I mean, that's nice rhetoric, but I mean, how do you do that? I mean, how do you show a state court closed its ears and mind? Does that mean that somebody's standing there trying to make the argument and the judge is just being dense? Or does that mean that there has to be some, you know, especially egregious error that takes place? What do you think it means?
Well, this court did give some examples in the Hampton case, and that is the type of situation that occurs, that this court said in Hampton, if it was some indication that the judge was bribed, that the judge was sleepwalking, or simply decided that probable cause was not going to be the standard in Illinois. It is a very high standard and simply is not met in this case. Basically, what the petitioner argues is that the appellate court in this case made some mistakes. That's not good enough to pierce the Stone bar. And even egregious errors have been held not to be enough unless the egregious error shows that the state court refused to take seriously its obligation to consider a claim under the Fourth Amendment. And that simply cannot be said in this case. The petitioner filed his motions before the trial court. The trial court held a hearing. It heard the testimony of the witnesses. It heard arguments of counsel. And then when it went to the appellate court level, the appellate court specifically stated it was deciding the case under Brown v. Illinois, set forth the four factors that should be considered in determining a whether a confession was sufficiently attenuated from any illegality, and then specifically referred to factors that would go to each of those factors.
What about the fact that the state court seems to have either accidentally or otherwise skipped over a close analysis of the intervening circumstances, though?
I don't believe that that the record shows that they did. The appellate court first said temporal proximity. Well, after Miranda, then they went to the second factor, temporal
right.
proximity, and agreed that it was very close. Just because the court did not specifically state, now we're going to intervening circumstances, I don't believe necessarily shows that they did not consider that factor, especially when the next discussion was about factors that would go to intervening circumstances. The fact that the victim had survived and that the petitioner knew he had been identified and that he had started making some type of confession to Officer Cooney earlier in the day, that wouldn't go to temporal proximity and necessarily, we believe, show that they were discussing intervening circumstances without necessarily, again, saying those words.
Mm-hmm.
And regarding the petitioner's contention that the intervening circumstances can only be considered between the time of the illegality and the time the petitioner confesses, the fact that the petitioner was legally in custody for 7 hours, I don't think would not mean that the court could not consider these factors that would show that the petitioner had other reasons to confess except for being confronted with the fact of the search. The petitioner was lawfully in custody for 7 hours when he was confronted with these various circumstances, believing his brother had been making a statement against him and otherwise. The fact that he is legally in custody should not take this out of the consideration of all the factors. The ultimate question is whether the record shows that the petitioner made the statement not based on the illegality but on other circumstances. So
right.
these other
yeah.
factors are important. Other than that, the petitioner in his brief cites to other reasons he believed the Stone bar should be pierced. He doesn't argue them before this court, so if there's any questions, there's no questions on that. The petitioner did not argue about the right to counsel before this court, so if this court does not have any questions on that particular issue.
We will assume the parties are standing on their briefs for those points.
If there's no further questions, then we would ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Rattler, you want your last minute?
Getting back to the standard, there is some support in the case law for how we get to the standard. And simply, it comes down to looking at the precedent, the Supreme Court precedent, and the instructions given there. And if the court fails for some reason to do it, that's enough to bring you past Brown v. Powell. As far as all the factors in between the violation and those facts that occurred before, the precedents from the Seventh Circuit, Supreme Court, state, all of them, you had to break the causal connection. And once he puts a couple of items in there about this before Watson says anything, how are you going to take that out? It's pregnant with it. You just can't take that out of the analysis. And the court wants to do that. Where are the other officers at? And then stop his thinking. But yet he has to speak after that. Court shouldn't have done that. As far as the standards again under Stone v. Pyle. When you fail to apply the constitution precedent of Brown, that brings us past the bar.
If you'd like to just wrap up at this point.
Dunaway cites the case so as an identical case. The Brown factors were set out clearly, but misapplied. It just wasn't used. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Rattler. Thank you to both counsel. The court will take a brief recess at this point and reconvene in a few minutes. this morning, Kemper Prime Industries against Montgomery Watson. Mr. Biederman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.